For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of your favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle. And this show is all about philosophy and deep thinking and the concepts behind that. Now, I have a confession to make, and that is the simple matter that there are times when the two gentlemen in the studio with me begin to talk about certain subjects, and my eyes glaze over.
And I've noticed.
Yeah.
You look over
there. Resting.
You look like you got two great big glazed donuts behind your glasses.
Right. Maple.
Yeah. And one of those subjects that consistently kind of puts me into, you know, this ethereal region where I'm kind of going, what are they talking about? What am I doing? Okay, it's time for a break. So that's my whole job here. But it's their job to talk about things. And so the one that always sends me into the question of what are they talking about is when they start talking about metaphysics.
You're not alone. A lot of people have that problem.
Okay, you know? If we can, today, gentlemen, can you bring metaphysics down to the level where I and maybe I'll say the above average listener out there can understand metaphysics?
Well, that's a tall order. Let's give it a try.
We could try, yeah.
Ask the impossible. I only ask the probable.
Right. And, you know, the thing is philosophy to a great extent started historically with metaphysics. So that question of what is sort of the constant truth behind everything that explains everything? You know, what can we find that's that sort of explanatory thread that works throughout the cosmos that gives everything its shape and order and all of that? And so, honestly, that's the question that the earliest, they call them pre-Socratic philosophers, started wrestling with. What are those little sort of elements and things out there that account for everything beyond what we can see and beyond what we can sense? So I think, you know, if you do want to take a deep dive into philosophy, if you do want to understand philosophy, you do have to, at least to a certain extent, wrestle with metaphysics. Now, you know, we live in a day and age where most philosophers probably kind of, if they don't outright reject the idea of metaphysics, they at least think that it's not worth spending a lot of time thinking about. So, can you philosophize without metaphysics? Yeah, you might be able to, but it's still worth knowing what other people have said about.
Yeah, I think metaphysics, see if you agree with this, Mark. So maybe a working organizing question might be for metaphysics tries to answer the question like, what is reality? And what's the nature of reality? And then I also picked up, now Wikipedia isn't always, so that's not always authoritative, but it can be a general source of information. And when you look up metaphysics in Wikipedia, I noticed it asked a couple of questions. What is it? What is there? And what is it like? And so metaphysics is sort of what's referred to in Latin as a priori discipline. So it's sort of like, as you were talking about, Mark, it's foundational. It's kind of what comes first. Physics refers to nature, meta, kind of prior to. So we have experience. So the modern physics, the science of physics, attempts to explain and understand and gain knowledge about the physical universe from the tiniest part to the macro. And yet, we kind of want to know kind of what's, is there something prior to the material realities that can account for our experience.
Right.
And does reality even exist? I mean, that's where some of this is today. Like, there's a denial of what we might call objective reality.
Well, yeah, at least the objective side of it, and yeah, the question as far as the nature of it. I'm not sure anybody really goes so far as to deny the complete existence of objective reality. They just sort of deny our ability to know it. But that, you know, that's near.
That's probably a good distinction. Right? I think of like a Sam Harris. He's got a real problem, I think. I don't mean that like in an argument.
Well, I guess you could read Sam Harris in one way of saying reality just is all. I mean, there really is nothing other than just sort of the objective world and any idea of consciousness, any idea of judgment, any idea of our ability to escape the mechanisms of nature is just illusory. But
we could do a whole
show on Sam Harris at some point.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about him before when we talked about free will. And that's where I think it's really helpful to like look at like a YouTube lectures. He's got a couple good ones on there as he explains his position. But it's what I referred to as brain fizz. He's convinced that, you know, each human person really is it's fully explained by biochemical reactions in our brain. And everything else is illusory,
right? I think the even more troubling thing with Sam Harris, and we'll get back to metaphysics in a second here, is you know, he is a radical determinist. So you know, there is absolutely nothing that is up to kind of rational choice in his view. So we have no ability to choose anything for ourselves. There is no free will. In his book. So, but anyway, that's like I said, that's for a show for another time.
But I brought it up the relative to metaphysics because, as you mentioned, I don't think he thinks you can't really. I think where he goes is you can't really determine if reality exists because you can't escape your own mind. And he's not the first one to come up with that. But you can't escape your own mind, and therefore you have no good evidence, no reliable evidence outside of your own kind of biochemical reactions in your brain, which you can't control. And therefore, you don't really know if reality's out there or not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he would go so far as to sort of deny Descartes, you know, cogito, you know, that even my own existence is illusory. I don't think he'd go so far as to say that, but I don't know.
He might get there. Maybe he's not there yet, but I think he's on that path.
Yeah. I'm kind of with Descartes. I don't think you actually can do that, but anyway, you know, and all of this conversation kind of gets to the problem with metaphysics. I think your definition of metaphysics was a pretty good one. You know, metaphysics is sort of the study of what is behind the scenes of reality, you know, whether it is there something even behind the scenes of what we see and touch and feel, and if there is, what's its nature. So I think that's a good definition. The problem with talking about metaphysics and why it gets so tricky and why people's eyes glaze over the moment you bring up
like
the word
Kent is already like started.
Kent is already dozing off over there.
Right. It's all warm in the studio too, by the way.
But the problem is you really can't say anything without making certain metaphysical commitments. So, you know, the minute you start talking about even trying to define what metaphysics is, you're making certain metaphysical statements that you got to go back and sort of try to piece together. You know, you had said in your definition of metaphysics that it's sort of the study of sort of the whole of reality all the way down to its little parts, etc. That's a metaphysical commitment right there. When you start to say that nature has parts, the nature can be broken down into discrete units that are discernible and are real. I mean, David Bohm would disagree with you. So, I mean, there's certain philosophers out there that have written and said, no, you know, the universe is just a whole. And then there's others that say there is no concept of a whole. There's only the parts and the units to it, and there's no sort of limits to understand any concept of a whole. And the idea that we have this idea of the universe just being one big thing, that's an illusion. You know, that's something that we've done. So the minute you start to talk about metaphysics, you're making certain commitments, and you're making certain assumptions.
Yeah, there's first principles, right?
Right, and those first principles ultimately, they're very hard to back up.
I've got one though. Yeah. Well, with first principles, I would say, I think going back to Aristotle would be the first I can remember kind of putting it this way, which is, you know, introducing this first principle of law of non-contradiction. One first and laws like of first principles involve insight. So these are things that do not appeal to other proofs or arguments, but the mind or intellect grasps the truth of them for their own sake. A quick example might be that the whole, W-H-O-L-E, is greater than a part. So you can immediately see, once you understand the terms, you immediately see the truth of that. I think when it comes to metaphysics, I think the first principle to begin with is that there's two categories, being and non-being. And if you can begin there, and I think you can kind of say, I think there some things exist and other things don't exist and other things don't exist. And so that to me would be a first principle of metaphysics. What do you think?
Right. Now non-being is a very confusing term. I mean, you know, what the heck do you mean by something that doesn't, that's non-being, that doesn't exist? I mean, when you talk about things being non-being, are you talking about unicorns or are you talking about my grandkids? You know, I don't have grandkids at the moment, but I very likely will in the future. Are those non-existent beings, or are you simply talking about thoughts? Are you talking about?
Well, I would say they're non-existent because they're contingent,
right?
They're contingent beings that haven't been brought into existence. So since they lack existence, they're non-being.
Right, right. So non-being has certain categories of in itself.
The category I would say is an absence of existence.
Right, right.
So if it has existence, it has being. If it doesn't exist, it's non-being.
Right. But now what does it take for something to have existence? I mean, we can talk about unicorns all day long. And we understand exactly what we're talking about. Not only you and me and Kent, but I could probably even go so far as to talk in a foreign language about unicorns, and we could be talking about the same thing. Do they have existence? Because there's something that really kind of exists outside of my own mind to a certain extent, mm-hmm. but they don't exist.
It's called God.
But they don't exist in the physical realm.
There's spiritual realities. Sure,
yeah, they're spiritual, but unicorns aren't a spiritual reality.
They're a non-material reality.
Okay, and with that, we're going to take a break and come back to unicorns and whether something is or isn't or to be or not to be. On the Catholic Cave, you're listening to Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford along with Timothy O'Donnell, Mark Tuttle. We've been talking about unicorns and to be or not to be and whether something is or isn't. And so, gentlemen, I pose this question. Is there such a thing as nothing? Because if you have nothing, you have nothing. But if you have nothing, you have something because you have nothing.
You know, and the funny thing is the more important metaphysical question is, why is there anything other than nothing? You know, why is there actually...
That's sort of the beginning question,
that is
right?
The beginning. Why is there existence? Why is there a universe? Why is there anything rather than nothing? Because mm-hmm. to have anything, it takes, to a certain extent, an action of bringing things into existence. So so the more fundamental question isn't, is there nothing, but why is there just anything more than nothing? And it does get back to that kind of question of the fundamental difference between being and non-being. And even posing that question, you're making certain metaphysical commitments. And I think that's the, you know, when you talk about metaphysics, all of this to a certain extent is up for debate, up for grabs. I mean, you're going to find philosophers that take one position or not. David Hume, I think, would probably be the most famous one that would kind of say, when you're talking about non-being, you're talking absolute silliness. Because anything, even a unicorn, the aspects of a unicorn are things that are in existent reality. So you've talked about something that does exist. You've talked about a horse with a horn. Horses exist, horns exist, and the only reason we have a concept of horns and horses is because we've seen them, or we've taken the word of somebody else that has seen them. And so there's nothing in our heads that doesn't have existence. And so the whole mental realm that we're talking about, the world of ideas when we're talking about unicorns, for David Hume, that's all existent. You know, there's nothing in your brain that's not out there in the real world somewhere that's not based off of experience to get into our heads and get into our ideas. So when you start talking about these things, you're making metaphysical commitments all along, and there's always going to be debate around it because, and I've always wondered, and maybe this is a metaphysical question too, so I'll pose it back to you, Tim. Why is it that there can be no proof to a certain extent, or no solid proof one way or the other, for any of these metaphysical concepts or metaphysical ideas?
Well, I think the proof is insight. So that's a commitment you have to make a commitment that the human being is rational, that we have an intellect with the power of reason, and then beyond that, I would say, as Catholics and other believing Christians, there's another reality that pertains to metaphysics, which is the supreme being himself, the existence of God. And so that's why a fundamental commitment to whether or not God exists is just so much flows out of one's position there. So once we recognize that God exists, God's the supreme being and the source of all existence, then for example, the creation narrative found in Genesis makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that metaphysical commitment that there is a source of all being, I think that just makes rational sense as well. You know, that because...
Sure, and that goes back to Aristotle and Aquinas, right, for the proofs for the existence
well, you know,
of God, our ways in which it begins to feel metaphysical. It's not... Those aren't just metaphysical arguments.
Right, and there's some strong differences between Aristotle and St. Thomas with that. You know, I mean...
That's why we need...
Yeah.
You got to read Fazer's book.
Right.
See, I name dropped.
Yep, right. Because, you know, I think Aristotle would argue, well, we can't really know that there's a source behind the universe. We can see a cause of change. We can see.
Well, he's got the first mover. He's got a first cause.
Right. But once again, that's a cause of movement. That's a cause of change. The idea mm-hmm. that I think for Aristotle, I think in a very real sense, the universe is eternal. The universe never really came into existence. It always has been.
That's how I read him too.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, the idea that there is a sort of source for existence is questionable, but that there is something that's beyond the universe that's sort of moving it and changing it and making it kind of appear the way it does. You know, Aristotle very much gets to that conclusion just through metaphysical logical deduction, you know, kind of taking a looking at the way things are and how they change and why they change. And as you move that back further and further, you say, you know, there's got to be something that's changing the way the universe is that isn't part of the universe itself.
And, yeah, I might tease that out in with a kind of parallel tracks. One would be when you talk about change, I think Aristotle and Aquinas and others would point to the relationship between act and potency. So, and then you get, and then you can trace that back to there has to be being that is act itself with no potency in it, that then is the source by which other things are acted upon. And it's parallel to his other argument, which is we mentioned before, contingency. So there's a point at which you were talking about where you're tracing back through time. There's no required, so contingent, things exist that aren't required to have existed. So you and I are, our parents didn't have to have children, but they did have children. Here we are. So we're contingent in that sense. If you trace that back through time, I think what you find in Aquinas building off of Aristotle is that there has to be sort of a non-contingent being that sort of sets the whole thing in motion, so to speak.
Right. And, you know, Aristotle didn't come to that notion out of a vacuum either.
He's just brilliant, though.
Right. But no, he's parsing kind of an argument that preceded him and preceded his teacher, Plato. And that is the question of change. And, you know, it's really a debate that goes back to two pre-Socratic philosophers. We keep using that term, mm-hmm. pre-Socratic philosophers. So, you know, if you, I guess you could look at philosophy starting in one of two places. Either philosophy kind of started with Plato, because he's really the first philosopher that we have a sort of solid written account of his thought and his writing to where we can kind of get a global picture of sort of what he thought. But there were several thinkers before him that you can go back and say, well, they were philosophers too, because they were wrestling with these same questions, maybe not in quite a systematic way. Maybe they were wrestling with it in a systematic way. We just don't have a record of it. That's another problem. And so we call those philosophers pre-Socratic, because Socrates was, in theory, the teacher of Plato, that Plato kind of documented everything mm-hmm. that Socrates said. So all of these that we don't have quite as much of a record, or we don't know how systematic they were, we call them pre-Socratic philosophers. And two of them, probably the two most important ones, they had a debate about the fundamental question of metaphysics. Now, we said, you know, on the one hand, you got the question of being and non-being, and then the next category is what these two pre-Socratic philosophers were debating about, and that is there change, or is change simply illusory? Is there permanence? And so Parmenides was the first of these, and his thought was the universe just sort of is. You know, this whole idea that the universe is changing and that things change and move along, that's all an illusion. That what really is simply being. And being itself doesn't change. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't. He came up with the idea, I think, long before physicists did, of the conservation of matter and conservation of energy. That really kind of goes back to a metaphysical commitment of Parmenides that everything is, and it doesn't go anywhere, and it doesn't change. And then Heraclitus was another pre-Socratic philosopher that said, exact opposite. Everything is changing. The idea that there's any permanence, that there's anything that doesn't kind of come and go, is illusory. And, the idea, and Heraclitus was one of those that called into the question of parts. For Heraclitus, there was just a whole. There were no parts. So it was all just one big changing ball of flux was his
in a certain sense thought. Some of that's back because we live in a time of hyper change, where things are changing all the time.
Right, right. And you know, that's the, and once again, that's the nature of a lot of these sort of metaphysical commitments and statements, is there's enough truth to any, I think, of these that they kind of come and go in fads. So you have, you know, you have an era where
it's a certain air of plausibility.
Right. And so that's really what, when Aristotle was talking about potency and actuality, what he was trying to do was show how, to a certain extent, both Parmenides and Heraclitus had a point, that both of them were correct. There are some things that do not change. And those things, we talk about potency. So those things that are sort of permanent, that don't change, are potential. But then there's change that comes about that brings them into actuality. There is change. So you've got permanent things, but then you've got other forces and things that work on those that bring about change. So there's both change and permanency that kind of coexist in a give and take of bringing things into being and bringing things back out of being. And so that whole process he described in terms of actuality and potency.
Well, I think also, I know we're coming up on a break here soon, I think a couple other terms that maybe should introduce that gets at this permanence and change, because that is really an important feature of reality, is substantial form, really, and accidents and matter. And so, yeah, form and matter, substance and accidents, those are also ways to kind of begin to understand this relationship between permanence and change. I'll give you a quick example. So we think about like the substantial form of a human being referred to as human nature. So you think about a human being, we go through a lot of change from conception to natural death. There's a lot of change that happens through normal development. And yet we're permanently a human being. We're never not a human being.
Right.
Throughout that whole trajectory of our life.
Right. And all of those terms come from Aristotle's mm-hmm. metaphysics and Aristotle's metaphysical conceptions, because to a good extent, St. Thomas took that and used that those metaphysical terms and that sort of metaphysical system that Aristotle had come up with to describe reality as a Catholic, and not only describe reality as a Catholic, but describe Catholicism in a way that it explained the universe to a good extent.
And with that, we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave attempting to explain the universe right after this.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I am Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. And
are you sure?
And I'm sure, yeah. That's because that question follows pretty naturally from what we've been talking about, because we are talking about, well, we're talking about life, the universe, existence, and everything. We are talking about metaphysics on this show. And, you know, metaphysics is really the conception of the concepts, ideas, and things that happen prior to experience that we sort of have to have an understanding of before we can really talk about anything else. Metaphysics is the study of that which underlies and accounts for and gives sort of a reason for existence and for meaning and for being. So that is my short form definition of metaphysics, and Tim's over there glaring at me because just in stating it that way, I'm making certain metaphysical commitments,
right,
as I'm going along.
I'm not glaring. I'm
and as we've been saying all along,
quizzical.
Yeah, anytime you talk about metaphysics, you're going to be making certain metaphysical commitments as you talk about it. And one of those that we keep kind of coming back to, we keep coming back to Aristotle's metaphysics, and we keep talking mm-hmm. about metaphysics in terms of Aristotle. And part of the reason for that is that this is the Catholic Cave. You know, the Aristotle, because of St. Thomas Aquinas, tends to be the backbone of Catholic metaphysics. And so I'm going to ask you, Tim, why is that? And why is that really true? Is St. Thomas's metaphysics the official metaphysics with a great big O of the Catholic Church?
I think so. I think it's the gold standard. We know that from various popes and saints who've referred to him as
even St. John Paul II.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Okay, good. Let's disagree. That's always fun. Well, I don't mean that in a I don't mean to say that St. Thomas Aquinas in a form that's not subject to being updated and advanced and developed. But when you look at, but he is the gold standard. But he's the theologian philosopher by which all others are measured. That's what I would say.
Yeah, you know, but St. John Paul II, I think, kind of updated that status of St. Thomas a little bit in Fides et Ratio.
Who displaced him then?
And that's what Fides et Ratio is calling for. So Fides et Ratio is really kind of a call to Catholic intellectuals, the way I read it, to find a new St. Thomas Aquinas. He lays St. Thomas out there as an example of what a Catholic philosopher sort of ought to be. But the call seems very clear in Fides et Ratio that, you know, Catholic intellectuals need to kind of keep the faith and continue to push and kind of go beyond where St. Thomas went. But he does throw him out there as an exemplary philosopher. There's absolutely no doubt about it. So, you know, but that being said, I do think, to a great extent so far, nothing has really come along that has sort of the central status that St. Thomas's metaphysics does. So everything that's proposed and put out there from Catholic philosophy always seems to have reference back to St. Thomas. So we're like kind of in a constant dialogue to a certain extent with St. Thomas as time goes on.
Well, I think the reason that Aquinas is, you know, indispensably valuable is that he articulates a perennial philosophy and theology that has enduring value, and he has put his finger on things that really don't change in terms of, say, first principles, but rather the call to action is about how to apply those principles and understandings in as things develop in the current setting.
Right.
So Aquinas, you know, 800 years ago, obviously had no way to anticipate, say, the challenges that you and I have talked a lot about on this show about, say, the challenges and threats to human life and human dignity. He had no concept of in vitro fertilization, genetic modification, things like that, engineering of people. So, and yet we can turn to Aquinas for a set of principles and understandings that we can apply into the current setting, because he's drawing from something that's, again, has eternal value, like the natural law. So, and I also think it serves as, he also serves as a kind of, for me, and I think for many, as a kind of a set of guardrails. In other words, you look for something like St. Cardinal Newman talked about, where reason can go awry. Reason can really spin out of control, and we're all familiar. We've heard some really crazy ideas, especially from academics.
Yeah, and we've been talking about some of them right here on the show, right, as we're talking about metaphysics.
Right.
Yep.
But Aquinas. So someone So there's a difference. So you could look for, where are we developing, and this applies to just Catholic doctrine overall. Where are we developing versus where are we contradicting or having a complete innovative break with truths that we know, settled truths that we know as part of our patrimony. So if someone flat out if there's a theologian or philosopher appears to have contradicted Aquinas, well, that's a red flag. That means it's not automatically an error, but you've got to really investigate,
right?
Because it's likely to be an error.
Yeah, and I think anybody that comes in and flat out contradicts St. Thomas Aquinas, they got a lot of splaining to do.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, they're gonna have to justify their position in some capacity.
Right, right. That's why I say he's the gold standard. But there are a lot of, I mentioned earlier, because I know you and I are really big fans. So I think one of the greatest really living philosophers. By greatest, I just mean he's really doing fantastic work, is Edward Fazer, right? And he's very much a Thomist.
Right, and he very much adopts St. Thomas's
correct. He presents his work anew.
I will say that's another, I think, thing that you can... I hate to use the term gold standard. I don't like that term when talking about St.
It reminds
Thomas.
Me of a credit card.
I know, but but anyway... But nonetheless, one of the advantages of St. Thomas's metaphysics is his durability. You know, St. Thomas, obviously the Summa is not like easy to understand, where you can just kind of pick it up and understand it and an easy read. But it's fairly easy to understand once you get the technical terms and the apparatus down to where you can apply it to most, if not all, of the problems that arise. And you can use St. Thomas's metaphysics to get a good, solid, general understanding of the universe, how the universe works, and have it as sort of a working metaphysics that's very durable and works well for most people. So I think... I think that durability of St. Thomas is something that kind of lends himself to being, a touchstone to a good extent for metaphysical questions.
Well, I'm going to slip in a plug for the Thomistic Institute at the Dominican House of Studies there in D.C. because they have those, I've mentioned it before, they have these short little YouTube videos under Aquinas 101, and they are doing a phenomenal job. It's mostly by the Dominican priest there, doing these short little 7, 8, 9 minute vignettes on elements of St. Thomas Aquinas's philosophy and theology that are just fantastic.
Yeah, and those videos, I think, demonstrate the durability of Thomas's metaphysics.
Right, right,
you know, because
right.
You know, the Dominicans do a fantastic job in those videos of making Thomas's concepts fairly easy to understand, and then they apply them, and they apply them in any number of ways to any number of, I won't call them questions, but any number of aspects of the world that shows how St. Thomas's metaphysics just sort of explains the way things are.
Right. So let's going back to metaphysics. What is your assessment, Mark, of the current state of affairs with just the philosophical circles maybe in which you travel in or interact or aware of about the current state of metaphysics?
Yeah, I would say the biggest metaphysical question is around the question of consciousness and the question of selfhood, identity. How is it that we come to see ourselves as individual beings, and is there really, is that a real thing? You know, when we see ourselves as individuals, is that real? I would think that would be kind of the central metaphysical question, which once again, for St. Thomas, that was almost not even a question that sort of occurred to him. Of course, we're individual beings. I am not Tim. Tim is not me.
Right.
We never could be. That's just sort of commonsensical. But the question of how much of who I am is based off of my experiences and what I've seen and what I've learned in the world. And how much of that is a constant? In other words, am I really the same person? You know, we take it almost as a foregone conclusion, but I think there's some reasons to kind of throw out the question: am I really the same person as I was when I was 9 years old? You know, when you start to think about what makes up a person, their fundamental beliefs, their fundamental experiences, their you know, everything foundational and fundamental about what you call a person is very different now than it was when I was 9 years old. And so, you know, am I really the same person as I was when I was 9 years old? You know, I think those are kind of some of the
Let's ask your wife.
Yeah. Well, she didn't know me when I was nine. Thank God. Thank goodness she didn't know me when
right,
I was
right,
nine.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, and the question of how experiences lead us to concrete realities, I think would be a metaphysical question. You know, what really is the nature of experience, and how is it that experience becomes things in our minds? Because they do. Experiences become things. And so I think the fundamental question that philosophers are asking out there is that real, or is that just an illusion?
Well, there's no allusion to the fact that we need to take a break. And so we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave with Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell right after this.
So the scan button brought you here. Awesome. We like company. Get to know us. And if you have to leave, come back. You're always welcome. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we are having a spicy show about metaphysics. Is that even possible to have a spicy discussion about metaphysics, Tim?
I don't think so. It's not that. It's more armchair philosopher kind of stuff.
You know, we're trying to keep it
in. We should have had a sniffer of cognac and a tasty cigar. That's what we should have been doing.
But at the end of the last segment, you had asked me sort of, so what are some of the kind of, I guess, more updated metaphysical questions that are out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I'm talking about this, I can see both you and Kent just sort of glaze over, because honestly, as Catholics, these aren't questions that we really ask. You know, the questions of, and I think for good reason, because Catholicism has the advantage of revelation. And with that advantage of revelation, I would say to a good extent, metaphysics is fairly settled for a Catholic. There's not too much that's going to metaphysically ruffle our feathers, so to speak. There's not too many questions out there that's going to change the way that the Catholicism sort of approaches and views the world. And so, you know, to a good extent, metaphysics for a Catholic, I would say, is settled. And as somebody that likes to ask these metaphysical questions and likes to think about things like identity, you know, that's a little depressing to me.
Well, you actually mean identity in a way that's not that in the traditional sense, not
right,
the way
right.
It's bandied
yeah,
about.
Yeah, that's true. And when you
in
say
regards to bathrooms,
yeah,
and
when
things
saying
like
I'm
that,
questioning my identity.
That's a different kind of identity.
Today's
right.
Day
just
age,
to clarify,
got to be careful with that
right,
statement
right,
today.
Right.
But no, I mean, you know, when you're looking at experiences, when you're looking at consciousness, when you're looking at those types of things, you know, I think for a Catholic, we've got certain metaphysical assumptions that are to a good extent settled. That, you know, as you said, St. Thomas kind of creates certain guardrails. And not just St. Thomas. I mean, I think the magisterium of the church to a certain extent puts up these guardrails that keep us from asking some of these questions in a deeper sort of way. And there's a good and maybe a bad to that.
I think a lot of here's where I'll agree with you, and I might disagree a little bit. I would say a lot of the metaphysical heavy lifting has been done. I think you're right. And so we have first principles. We have a lot that we know based on some settled truths. First and foremost, and again, I love the fact that you brought up Fides et Ratio by St. John Paul the Great, because it's a great source of this interplay between, because metaphysics, I think, is often done best at or considered at its finest when we look at that intersection of faith and reason. And I think that's where metaphysics goes in the contemporary setting goes wrong. And that's when you have the denial of faith, the denial of God, the denial of the supernatural. And when philosophers and other thinkers have tried to relegate, I'll take neuroscience as an elements of neuroscience relegate metaphysics to a kind of deterministic materialism, then you're going to have a lot of problems. So I do think the Catholic intellectual tradition is very robust, very well thought out, very coherent, and ready to face, I would say, new challenges if and when they arise. And one I'll bring up because it's always kind of fun to talk about, because I think there's been a lot of kind of ancillary news stories about UFOs. So UFO sightings, that kind of stuff. So I'm not of the mind. I don't know. I don't know what to make of that stuff, honestly, because I love science fiction. I always have. I grew up watching Star Trek and stuff.
Right.
But
yeah.
But it would be really interesting. Do you think there would be any type of metaphysical challenge if one or more sentient alien life forms presented themselves and, you know, were able to communicate back and forth?
I don't know if it would pose metaphysical questions, but it would definitely pose questions that would affect the intersection of metaphysics and ethics. And I think one of those, particularly for Catholics, that it would pose is, we kind of recognize humanity as a special creation. We recognize humanity as something transcends the natural order, and we participate to a great extent with God. And we see ourselves as privileged in creation of being able to, and I mean, this has any number of implications, that we are co-creators with God. No other animal can kind of co-create the way humanity can along with God.
Yeah.
And if we ran into
other creatures reproduce.
Right.
But we co-create because we always have the immortal soul.
You know, and to kind of go back to some of the... once again, the intersection of ethics and metaphysics, Hannah Arendt, I think, is one of the philosophers where she really gets at this intersection. And, you know, when you have a being like humanity that can kind of transcend the natural order to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. That could be Eric Voegelin, too.
Yeah. But, you know, nature is very cyclical. You know, when you go back to the question of constancy and permanency versus change, I think for an animal... their experience of the universe is very much as an unchanging whole that just continues to be the same over and over again.
I don't know. Barney the Wonder Dog, our 130-pound chocolate lab, notices the food bowl's empty. The food bowl is full. He notices the change.
He notices it, but for him...
I know what you're saying.
For his universe, that food bowl goes through a cycle.
Well, he has no concept of universals like we have.
Right. And for him, though, life is just one big cycle. It's the food bowl emptying, the food bowl falling, the food bowl emptying, the food bowl falling.
Right.
And also the reproductive lifestyle cycle of animals.
That's kind of over for him, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. But I mean, you live, you die, you procreate, there's more beings that come in. It's a big cycle. Mm-hmm. Humanity has the unique advantage of being able to add to, escape from, or create on top of that cycle. And that's really when we are living most humanly. When we are living most as human beings, we are being creative. And that creative force within the world is love. And that's why we kind of recognize that Barney the Wonder Dog, as much affection as you have for him, as much as he wags his tail and all of that, it's not genuine love that he feels for you. Not an
blasphemer. Yes, he does.
So we recognize that humanity has, because of who we are, because of God, of who God's made us, we have sort of a privileged status here on Earth. And I think you're right. I think if we discovered aliens, that would be called into question almost instantly, assuming that they're the type of aliens that exist in like Star Trek or someplace like that, where they're sentient beings that seem to exhibit rationality along the lines that we do. That creative spark and that ability to love and that ability to kind of co-create with God, is that just exclusively for humans, or does that exist for other aliens as well? That would be I don't know if it would be a metaphysical question, but that'd be a question.
There's a lot of theological implications, right? Because of the Think of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and the incarnation, then his life, his death, resurrection, the fact that he's a divine person, fully God, fully man. So that to me would be, how would a sentient alien life form or forms, you know, how do they stand in relation to the reality of that?
Right. And what does it really mean to be a sentient being? I think that's another question.
That brings up AI.
I was just going to.
We don't have time now because we're almost out of time for this show anyway. But yeah, artificial intelligence, you know, can a machine ever achieve consciousness?
Right. I think that's why that question of consciousness is so out there in the sort of metaphysical question realm, is because AI seems to be reproducing so much what we would call a conscious being. I mean, I think we all have conversations right now. They may be primitive conversations, but we all have conversations with our smartphones. When you think about that's sort of a very strange thing. Or maybe I'm just a strange
person. What are you saying to your smartphone, buddy? I don't like to talk to mine. Turn Siri. Although I do use Alexa to play Catholic Radio Indy at home with a clear signal.
Exactly. And you can ask Alexa to play Catholic Radio, and she does.
But she's listening too.
And she's listening all the time. And right. You can ask her what
feeding
the weather is.
Feeding
it
into my smartphone. I've noticed
you can interact with your cell phone in a conversational type of way. And that's what I mean. We can have conversations with our cell phones.
Do you guys ever feel funny when you ask Siri for something and Alexa's in the room?
It's a kind of infidelity, yes.
Do you ever wonder if Alexa and Siri get jealous of each other?
Do they even know each other?
I'm sure they do.
I bet they talk about us behind our backs. They know everything.
They do know everything.
And, you know, that leads to another sort of metaphysical question. And it gets to the consciousness, and that's the question of homonization. You know, what is it that makes a human being a human being? What was that step that moved us from being animals into being humans?
Not convinced that step even took place. I don't know that we are ever something other than human.
Right, right. And that would be one position.
Correct.
But within Catholic circles, I think this gets back to the question that I started this segment with, is are all metaphysical questions within the Catholic Church fixed? That question of homonization would be one that, no, I think there's a lot of robust debate among Catholic philosophers of what is it that moved us to being human? You know, how was it that God created Adam? That Adam existed, that there was an Adam from which the whole rest of the human race came. That's an article of faith, but how was Adam created? There's a lot of room for kind of thought and speculation and trying to deduce what it was that set Adam apart from the rest of creation.
Yeah. Or what brought about did God intervene in some sort of evolutionary trajectory? And at a certain point, infuse a rational, immortal soul.
I'm not wholly
convinced of.
Was this a sort of moral awakening? And I think that's one, sort of one realm of looking at homonization that, we suddenly had awareness to a certain extent of something beyond ourselves. And with that awareness, we suddenly became human. You know,
yeah, that entails something. Working. Jimmy Akin was talking about it not that long ago, in part. And were there other like humanoids? You have actual human beings with immortal souls, rational immortal souls, surrounded by humanoids, human-like,
right,
that weren't, and then we bred with them. I mean, it was really kind of strange.
Yeah, yeah.
Going down. And he was trying to answer this question of like, in the early narrative of Genesis, you know, like, and the beginning of the human race, you know, there's questions about, you know, proximity to kin and reproduction that were raised, and he's trying to, he's speculating. That's the
right,
key.
Right.
He's guessing, right? He's making educated guesses.
But I think when you look at that process, you get back to the sort of the central importance of metaphysics, that metaphysics are those assumptions that you have to make to even be able to ask those questions and answer those questions. And, you know, somebody like Jimmy Akin, he's got a certain set of metaphysical commitments. For Jimmy Akin, I would presume most of them come from St. Thomas, but there may be, you know, a few other metaphysical commitments thrown in there that he's learned over the years. But that basic fundamental ground of understanding what the universe is, how it works, those are the types of things that you have to kind of have an understanding of before you can even start to ask those questions.
And at this point, I'm not sure we've really defined metaphysics. We've attempted. We've gone a long way and covered a lot of distance, everything from unicorns to Star Trek. But we'll be back with more next time on The Catholic Cave. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.